From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Guy Raz. Getting the kids out the door in the morning can be a challenge for any family, but Seattle schools think they have the solution. Enlist the help of favorite musicians and athletes. Charlotte Baer of member station KPLU reports on the city's new plan to improve school attendance.
Isaac Bennett lives just a few houses down from his high school in North Seattle. Yet the 16-year-old junior didn't make it there very often last year.
I had like 167 absences for sophomore year, which wasn't good.
That's right. He ditched 167 times. One of his biggest struggles was first period world history. Seems getting up was tough because he'd stay up late to toss a virtual football around on the Xbox.
He drops the easy pick.
Come on. That's one thing about Madden. I get too much into it sometimes.
Try as they might, his parents were no match for the mock New England Patriots. They'd tell him to shut off the game at 9:30, again at 10 o'clock, then 10:30. They'd even try taking it away.
But they'll eventually fall asleep, and I would just, behind their back, just like still play video games when they're not awake.
His parents didn't have much more luck in the mornings. Once they went to work, no one was there to shoo him off to school, until now.
Yo, what up? It's your boy Wiz Khalifa, man, from Get School, talking to all you kids in Seattle, letting y'all know y'all need to get up out of the bed and go to school. Get to class on time.
Bennett says Wiz Khalifa can get him going because he's one of his favorite rappers.
Yeah, you know what it is. Everything I do, yeah, I do it big. Yeah.
Other celebrities, including America's Next Top Model host Tyra Banks and pro quarterback Tavares Jackson, have also recorded wake-up calls students can sign up for through the National Get Schooled Foundation. Seattle officials are pushing the calls, plus a variety of prizes and mentorship programs, to motivate truant kids to change their ways. Mayor Mike McGinn is leading the charge.
The statistics around attendance are very compelling. If somebody misses more than 10 days of school a year, I'm a very high predictor that they're not going to finish high school.
McGinn's office is spending nearly $50,000 to coordinate and implement the effort. Local businesses are donating the prizes, everything from VIP concert tickets to free gourmet ice cream for the whole school. McGinn says the model is similar to a fairly successful approach in New York.
It's a very clear statement that being in school matters. But it's also a message to the broader community that they have a role to play in getting engaged.
You know, if they get a job, there's not going to be somebody calling them saying, "Hi, it's Michael Jordan, and it's time for you to wake up."
Peter Colino teaches math at Ingram High School, where Isaac Bennett skipped all those classes.
Because if they don't go to work, they're simply not going to have their job. And this is what happens if you don't come to school, you don't graduate.
Besides, he says flashy prizes and celebrity robocalls won't fix family issues or other problems that keep a lot of students from making it to school. Still, high school junior Isaac Bennett says for him, these incentives can be the extra little push he needs.
Just, I guess, to keep myself motivated, like, oh, I'm getting prizes and I'm doing a good job in school, you know. Ding, like, I'm coming to school every day.
While he hasn't quite done that, his attendance has dramatically improved. Adults behind the effort say getting kids to school more is the whole point, and it doesn't matter if it takes pizza, sports stars, or musicians to do it. For NPR News, I'm Charlotte Baer in Seattle.
Eddie Murphy is out. He quit today as host of the next Academy Awards broadcast. His announcement comes after the departure of the Oscar ceremony's producer. Brett Ratner used a homophobic slur and quit in response to public anger. Ratner is also the director of Murphy's latest film. NPR's Ina Jaffe has the story.
Brett Ratner has talents for directing, for producing, and apparently for making a bad thing worse. A couple of days after he used that homophobic slur, he went on the Howard Stern show, where he engaged in a long, rambling discussion of the graphic details of his sexual practices and partners, almost none of which is airable on this broadcast. Okay, well, this may be about Lindsay Lohan.
She came home, and I had a Victoria's Secret model in my bed, and they got in a huge fight, and it was like a crazy thing at my house.
Ratner's reputation as a bad boy was no secret, says Kim Masters, editor-at-large for The Hollywood Reporter, but she says the Academy must have felt hiring him was worth the risk.
There's this desire to try to be young and relevant, and I think there was just a hope that this would boost the Academy show ratings.
Eddie Murphy resigning right after Ratner was no surprise, says Masters, but it won't do him any good either.
Eddie Murphy has well established a reputation now as being a difficult personality. He is now delivering another insult to the movie business.
The Motion Picture Academy said it wished Murphy well. In a statement on Ratner's departure, the Academy said he did the right thing for the Academy and for himself. And as with all Hollywood scandals, there's rehab. In this case, Ratner is working with the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation on a series of public discussions of homophobic slurs in movies and television. Ina Jaffe, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
A warning now, the following conversation will contain no obscenities, no violent references, no graphic descriptions of unmentionable deeds, but it will contain an extremely irritating sound, a sound that, as new research tells us, human beings are predisposed to detest. It is the sound of a fingernail on an old-fashioned chalkboard. Brace yourself, here it is. Ooh, just one more time. I promise we will not do that again. What we will do is ask an expert why many of you had that spine-tingling, hair-raising reaction just now. Michael Oehler of the University of Media and Communication in Cologne, Germany, joins us. Welcome to the program.
Hello. I'm glad to be here.
And tell us, what did you learn? What's so special about this particular sound that we hate it?
Well, the aim of the study was to detect specific features of the sounds responsible for the perceived unpleasantness. And we wanted to know if there was a correlation between perception and physiological reactions. And the most significant result was that the parts of the sounds in the frequency range between 2,000 and 4,000 Hz were particularly important for the perceived unpleasantness. And that is remarkable because between about 2 and 4 kHz, the human ear is most sensitive, and many important acoustic features of speech sounds can be found in this area.
So are there other sounds that occupy the same range of, actually there are two meanings of the word hertz here, the same range of hertz as the sound of fingernails on the chalkboard?
Yeah, we tested another sound that was just chalk on a board.
Chalk on the blackboard.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and we got about the same results with the chalk.
And it's just the way our ears have evolved that this happens to be a particular range of sounds that we react to very badly.
Yeah, one explanation for the sensitivity of the ear in this area is the open ear gain. Some frequencies are amplified due to the anatomy of the ear canal. But we also found that pitch information is very important for the perceived unpleasantness. And if these two things go together, this makes a very unpleasant sound perception.
This knowledge may be too late for the blackboard industry. I think the chalkboard has sort of died since you started the research. It's been replaced by the whiteboard and the magic marker, or whatever we call the felt tip pen.
Yeah, that's true. But we also have many other sounds, and the knowledge could be used to make them a bit more pleasant. If you think about sounds of a vacuum cleaner or whatever, but you could use this knowledge to operate in these frequency areas and make the sound a bit more pleasant.
You're saying just get that vacuum cleaner sound out of the 2,000 to 4,000 hertz range, and people will not react so badly to it when they turn it on, is what you're saying.
Yeah, it's just one example. I don't know if it really works with a vacuum cleaner, but there are many sounds in our environment that are perceived as unpleasant, and perhaps it's a way to make it a bit more pleasant.
Did you find in your research that if you just told people, I'm now going to play you the sound of fingernails scraping on a blackboard, that they had the reaction that we have from hearing the sound?
Yeah, exactly. If the subjects knew about the origin of the sounds, the judgments tended to be more negative, and the correlation between the perception and the physiological reaction was even stronger. And conversely, if the subjects thought they were hearing parts of a contemporary composition, what we told them, they perceived the sounds as less unpleasant. So this was really striking.
So the reaction would depend on how avant-garde the experiment subjects might be.
Yes, we should test this also as a variety. Yes, that's true.
Well, Professor Oehler, thank you very much for talking with us about your work.
You're welcome. I was glad to talk to you.
Okay, that's Michael Oehler, who is Professor of Media and Music Management at the University of Media and Communication in Cologne in Germany. He's part of a team of researchers who just presented a paper at the Acoustical Society of America conference about why fingernails on chalkboards are so irritating to the human ear.
Uh, Our program is directed today by Brendan Banaszak, edited by Corey Turner and Franklin Cater, and produced by Matt Martinez. The technical director is Stu Rushfield. The engineering supervisor is Robert Jackson.
At the foreign desk, Ted Clark, Kevin Beasley, Douglas Roberts, and Martha Wexler. Librarians include Mary Glendinning, Denise Chen, Beth Howard, Janelle White, Maureen Clements, Hannah Summers, Robert Goldstein, Elizabeth Allen, and Lauren Sin.
Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin. I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Robert Siegel. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
In Alabama today, the Jefferson County Commission voted to declare bankruptcy. The filing is estimated to be more than $4 billion, and it would be the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. The county has been trying for 3 years to negotiate a settlement with creditors. Tanya Ott of member station WBHM joins us now from Birmingham for more. And Tanya, I know this is complicated, but how did Jefferson County get into these troubles?
Well, Guy, Jefferson County is home to Birmingham, and it's the state's biggest county. More than 650,000 people live here. Now, many years ago, the county's aging sewer system needed to be replaced. The county took out some risky bonds to pay for that. There was some public corruption, which landed several county officials in prison. Then, of course, you throw in the down economy and a budget shortfall. Even the governor and the legislature tried to intervene in recent months to broker a deal with Wall Street creditors. But the sides just couldn't agree, which led to today's decision to declare bankruptcy.
Now, I understand that there have been months of negotiations between the county and creditors. Why did those break down?
You know what? No one knows at this point. The two sides had held marathon negotiating sessions. Even in recent days, the governor and state lawmakers had issued statements seeming to indicate a deal could be reached to avert the bankruptcy. Now, under Alabama law, the state would have to sign off on any deal, and one of the plans would have sliced $1 billion off what Jefferson County owed to Wall Street banks. It would have done that in exchange for higher sewer rates. Those talks broke down, though, because not all of the region's lawmakers could agree on what to do.
So what does this all mean for people living in Jefferson County and in the rest of the state of Alabama?
Well, that's a really good question. At this point, no one really knows. The county already faces a massive budget shortfall because a court ruled a jobs tax was unconstitutional. That forced the county to lay off hundreds of workers, close some government offices. This is another blow to the region. Now, late today, Alabama Governor Robert Bentley issued a statement saying that he's disappointed by the county's decision to file for bankruptcy because it would negatively hurt not only the Birmingham region, but the entire state.
So this is a done deal.
It appears that it is. The county actually follows through and files bankruptcy. That means the county loses control of its financial affairs, and it goes straight into the hands of a federal bankruptcy judge. At that point, Guy, it's really anyone's guess how long this will take, how much it'll ultimately cost residents, and how other folks around the country are going to view Alabama in light of what would be the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history.
Tanya, what about people who live in Jefferson County? I mean, you presumably are a citizen of the county. What do people there saying about this? And presumably it's embarrassing, but are people worried about what might happen?
You know, it is embarrassing, obviously, and people are concerned about what other folks across Alabama will think of Jefferson County and its residents, also what folks around the country will think of us. I think there's a little bit of fatigue, though. We've been hearing about this for, you know, 3.5 years. This started back in 2008, and it seems like day in and day out, we've had newspaper articles and television reports and radio reports about sewer debt, about corruption, about bankruptcy. This isn't the first time that we've come down to the wire on making a decision. This is actually the third or fourth time that we've come down to the wire in what we've called a bankruptcy watch here in Jefferson County. So, you know, I think for certain folks at this point, it's a done deal. We know what's happened, and we're just going to let out a big sigh and figure it out from here.
Tanya, thanks.
Thank you.
That's Tanya Ott of member station WBHM reporting from Birmingham on the news that Jefferson County has declared bankruptcy, making it the largest municipal bankruptcy filing in U.S. history.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Guy Raz. A cheerless announcement at the end of a celebrated career. Pennsylvania State University's storied football coach Joe Paterno says he'll retire at the end of this season. He makes that move as a scandal and gulfs the Penn State program. The team's former defensive coordinator Jerry Sandusky faces charges of sexually abusing 8 boys over a period of 15 years. Paterno calls the situation one of the great sorrows of his life. NPR's Jeff Brady reports.
In the written statement, Paterno says, quote, "With the benefit of hindsight, I wish I had done more." According to the grand jury charges, a graduate student who says he witnessed Sandusky molesting a boy in a locker room in 2002 came to Paterno's house the next day. The coach waited another day before reporting that to university officials. Critics have suggested that given his position in the community, Paterno should have gone straight to the police. This Friday, the university's Board of Trustees is expected to meet and appoint a special committee to investigate the scandal. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett sits on that board, and he had this to say about Jerry Sandusky and the allegations against him.
He who preys on a child is the worst type of person in the world, as far as I'm concerned. That's why I have urged the board to deal with this quickly and swiftly. Other comments have to wait until after the board meetings, until after they take an action.
Meanwhile, several dozen reporters waited outside Joe Paterno's house all day, hoping rumors that he'd come out and make a statement were true. Penn State freshman Cameron Rowe stopped by the coach's house and put a letter of support in his mailbox. As he left, reporters ran to catch up with him and ask what he wrote in the letter.
Like, the sun will come up tomorrow and we'll always be Penn State. That's how I ended it. I have to get to class.
What's your name?
On CNN this afternoon, the student body president for Penn State's largest campus, T.J. Bard, responded to Paterno's resignation.
I think students are shocked. They're very surprised at the announcement. I think a lot of students are heartbroken. We've heard stories of students leaving their classes in tears, students coming together and really just reflecting on Paterno's legacy and his career here at Penn State.
It's difficult to overstate how strongly many students say they feel about Joe Paterno, or Joe Paw, as they call him. Last night, more than 100 rallied outside his house. Many used words typically reserved for close family to describe how they feel about him. Nearby on the Penn State campus, hundreds gathered on a large lawn. Students also stood guard at a statue of Joe Paterno, just to make sure no one would try to vandalize it in the wake of the scandal that's happened under his watch. But talk to people around town, and many are now starting to focus more on the victims, the 8 boys who have been identified so far who were allegedly molested. Jonathan Light is president of the Teamsters Local 8 in State College. Among his members are janitors, one of whom is counted as a witness in the grand jury indictment. Light says 2 years back, that member called him for advice.
I encouraged him to talk to the police. The police wanted to investigate these claims against Jerry Sandusky.
Light says he's been disappointed about so much attention being paid to Joe Paterno's career as football coach and less to the victims.
You know, having kids and understanding Joe is a legend and so on, but we need to be taken care of. In my heart, and I'm sure all of our members' hearts, go out to the victims here and their families. And you don't hear much support for those folks. And that's what we should be focusing on right now, is making sure they're taken care of.
But doing that, taking care of them, is difficult. These people were boys when they became victims, and their names have been kept secret. Now at least a few of them are adults, but so far they've chosen to remain anonymous. Jeff Brady, NPR News, State College, Pennsylvania.